There's plenty of bad news, even tragic news out there today, but how about tuning in to an inspiring story you've never heard before from a decorated World War II prisoner of war?
They called me gallantry in action by saving the nose gunner, and I had a small wound in my forehead. My wife says my head was too hard.
And that was just the first close call in a series of incredible developments. I'm Paul Leffler, hoping you'll join me for the rest of that story on Hometown Heroes, today at 1 on News Talk 580 or 5 p.m. on FM 105.9 KMJ.
News Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes with you every Saturday here on KMJ. Whether you listen to us on the AM side on 580 at 1 o'clock, on the FM at 105.9 every Saturday at 5, or anytime online at kmjnow.com. I bet you figured out by now the idea behind this show, that we want to honor our veterans for their service and their sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories for posterity, and along the way be reminded that no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are heroes around you, and you have no idea what they've done for the sake of our freedom. If you are from the west side of the valley, as I am, you know about the city of Gustine. And if you've spent any time in Gustine, maybe you've come across the Wilbur and Irene Gomes Gustine History Center. We're going to talk to that History Center's namesake today, a man who was a prisoner of war in World War II, a guy who had three planes shot out from under him. There is a lot to talk about today. I'm joined by 88-year-old Wilbur Gomes of Gustine, California, on the west side of the San Joaquin Valley. And Wilbur, you got to Gustine pretty early, huh? You were about 2 years old when your family moved there?
Yes, I was born in Newark, and I came here at 2 years of age, and I've been here ever since.
What was Gustine like in the 1940s?
Oh, we only had 1,500 people population here, but it was very prosperous because we had all the dairy farms that had 40 acres and cows, and on Saturday night, I can remember as a child going to downtown, we had one big street. And all these people came into town to go to the theater or to shop.
So I'm sure you did plenty of that before graduating from Gustine High School, home of the Redskins.
Yeah, I graduated in 1941. And I had just completed my first semester at Cal, and Pearl Harbor happened on that Sunday. Next day was our first finals.
So what did that do to you? How did you find out about that, and how big of a shock to your system was it?
You mean about Pearl Harbor?
Yes.
They blacked out the whole Bay Area. I was in Berkeley, of course, and they blacked out every single light, even headlights on cars, because they figured the Japanese were coming to California, which, of course, was impossible because they just barely made it to Hawaii. But we didn't know that.
No, you didn't. And you're only 17 at the time.
That's correct.
But I bet there was part of you that wanted to do something about it right away.
Well, I completed my 5 days of finals. I had a final every day for 5 days after Pearl Harbor on Sunday. As soon as I got out, I went down to the recruiting station. And I said, I want to re-enlist and go kill those Japs. I was so angry.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, how old are you? I said, 17. Hey, you go back to college and to get into cadet training and officer training, you've got to be 18 and have 2 years of college. So that's what I did. I finished my second year by going through two summer sessions, and I completed in December of 42 when I went into the service.
And you decided to enlist in the Army Air Corps.
Oh, yeah, right off the bat, that's what I wanted to do. I had a fascination with flying ever since I was a little kid.
Did you join the Air Corps because you wanted to be a pilot?
Yeah, I did. I thought I'd be a pilot because I had an aggressive nature and, you know, what do you call it, type A.
Uh-huh.
And so I thought I was going to be a pilot, but they took us to Santa Ana and gave us a whole series of tests. The scores going from 7 to 10, and I scored 10 on the navigation because I had a lot of numerical training.
Mm-hmm.
I was an accountant at Cal.
So they said, we think we can use you best as a navigator.
Yes, they decided, of course, the Army. We had no voice in the matter.
So you knew as a navigator you're going to be flying on some multi-engine planes, some bombers. What was the first taste of a flight on a bomber that you had?
They sent us from Santa Ana to Texas, and we went to pre-flight in Ellicott Field at Houston, And then they sent us to San Marcos, which is just outside of Austin, Texas. And there we had our advanced flying training, which lasted about 5 months. And we learned how to do celestial navigation and dead reckoning. We had four different kinds of methods to use, those two, and the radio, which was not very good at that time, and pilotage, which you looked at the railroad and just watched yourself. So when I graduated there in February of 44, I came directly to California. We set a new record coming across from Texas to California. My friend had the only car in the whole bunch of us, and he brought me to L.A., and then I took the train north, and my wife picked me up at Modesto, which is 30 miles north.
So you got married before heading overseas?
Yes, just before. I was married on March 4th, and I left in April. I was only married, I think, 6 weeks.
Well, I guess we ought to get the story of how you and your wife met, because you've been married now for 68 years, and you survived as a prisoner of war, and she stuck around waiting for you all this time. Give me the story of how you and Irene initially got together.
Well, we were in high school together. I went to a small school between Gustin and Newman called Canal School, and she was the city girl, Gustin City Elementary School, so we didn't know each other in grammar school, but we became freshmen at the same time. And, of course, she caught my eye. And we didn't do anything until I was a senior, so we were a couple since 1940.
Wow, that's impressive. That's a long time. And
that is. Of course, we didn't get married till 44.
But you got married before you headed overseas, and I'm sure both of your families were proud.
Oh, yes, they were pretty shook up. I don't think my father expected to see me again.
Well, that's I know a lot of people did wait, and they didn't get married before going over because of that concern. So what made you so sure that you would make it back to this young bride of yours?
I was a big optimist. Nothing can happen to me. That's the only way you can get through this thing.
Little did you know. While we're on the topic of your wife, and you and Irene share the Portuguese Azorean heritage that is so common on the west side.
Oh, yeah, 100% Portuguese.
There you go. I want to ask you, her brother, in fact, I mentioned that the History Center in Gustin is named after you two.
Yes, we donated the building.
And the VFW post in Gustin.
It's named after her brother, Joe.
Joe Rose was the first.
Joseph G. Rose, first casualty in World War II from Gustin.
Mm-hmm. And did that happen before you headed overseas?
Yes, it happened in 43, and I didn't go overseas until 44.
So how difficult was that for your wife and for you to deal with this loss?
Well, I was at Cal, so I didn't see her very often. I'd get hitchhiked from Berkeley to Gustin about every 2 months and visit with her and my parents. And so we didn't see very much of each other after I got up to Cal.
She lost her brother, and I'm sure you knew Joe as well, right?
Yes.
Where did he die in the war? What happened?
Oh, he died at Attu up in the Aleutian Islands.
Mm.
The Japanese had occupied the island, and of course that was the only island, I mean the only territory in the ground in World War II that they invaded, actually in our land. So they took it over, and they were going to use that as a stepping stone to get to California and the West Coast. And so that's when they decided they got to do something about them. And Joseph G. Rose, my brother-in-law, they had trained in the Mojave Desert, which, you know, is out near Bakersfield. They had desert training, and they were supposed to go to North Africa and fight Rommel. Instead, they got sent to Attu without the proper equipment, without the proper clothing. They had summer clothing, and they were sent to frigid Alaska.
I've heard from some of those veterans.
It was horrible.
So he is killed up there. Here's his sister mourning, and now you must have done quite a sales job to get her to marry you before you went overseas after she'd already lost her brother in this war.
Well, she was still grieving, of course, but I was in Texas, and she gave me a letter every day, so we were pretty close.
And when you were getting ready to head overseas as part of the 98th Bomb Group as a navigator, that goodbye with her, did you make some kind of big promise that you'd be back, or how did that unfold?
Oh, it never came up. I was going to be back.
No doubt about it.
The optimist, nothing can happen.
Mm-hmm.
We got married in March, and I only had 3 weeks to get to Colorado Springs, where I met the rest of my crew. That's where we formed a crew for the B-24, my first ride in a B-24.
And what'd you think of that plane? Because I've talked to a lot of guys who really love that plane, and of course it has its detractors too because of its appearance and that flying anvil moniker that people have thrown at it.
Oh yeah, we love that airplane. It can take such a punishment and still keep flying. I think I told you about the first raid over Austria where they had 86 holes in our wings.
Well, let's tell all our listeners about that. Now, this was your very first mission?
No, it was the 10th mission.
Your 10th mission.
I flew 38 missions altogether, shot down in my 38th.
And you were shot up a couple times before that. So this was a very eventful one.
Yeah,
tell us about what your target was, where you guys took off from, and how that mission unfolded.
I was transferred from Colorado Springs to somewhere in Kansas. They had made a Ford factory into an airplane factory. So we had a brand new airplane right next door. And the day I left, it was raining so hard I couldn't see across the street. And I waved goodbye to Irene. She was standing in an upstairs window. And I said, I'll be back soon. And I got to the base. And they said, here's your orders. Take this crew to Italy. That was a shocker. I was only 20 years old.
Mm.
So we flew to Puerto Rico the first night, and it rained all the way. And we stayed overnight in Puerto Rico. Then we flew to South America. It was a jumping off place because it jutted out into the Atlantic, the same as Dakar, which was in Africa. Mm. So it was the shortest distance between the two continents. And we flew for 12 hours to get that 2,400 miles across. And I had to use celestial navigation, and the rest of the crew all fell asleep, and except the pilot, of course. we got there just as dawn was breaking, and I saw the Dakar, which was right on the coast, and I was so thankful because for much of the night I couldn't see the stars and couldn't do the celestial, so I was really doing dead reckoning because they had given us, of course, the weather. And it was exactly what they had predicted. So we weren't very far off course, maybe 10 miles.
I'm sure you breathed a sigh of relief when you actually saw Dakar.
Oh, God, you can't imagine. When you've been up in the air 12 hours trying to make sure you're going the right spot, boy, it wasn't really, the crew thought I was a hero.
Well, I guess so. And the government would eventually say that about you, too, with some of the decorations we're going to talk about. But
like I told you, we flew to Dakar, and then we flew up the Atlas Mountains on the coast of Africa, and we flew across to where the B-29s were being flown to go to India. And then we flew across Sicily, and we were stationed at a former Italian air base on the heel of Italy.
Mm-hmm.
You know how Italy is shaped as a shoe. And we were on the heel called Lecce, L-E-C-C-E. And it was a former Italian base and was well paved, and the Germans had taken it away from them, and then we took it away from the Germans. So it was an established base. We lived in tents there. We had no housing, of course, and it had a central mess hall. And then we would get our briefings in the morning. We'd have to get up at 2 o'clock and go to the briefing room where they told us what the target was. They always had it covered up on the front of the room, so we didn't know what was happening until they pulled that thing off. And when they would pull off the covering and show us Pulaski, we'd all go, oh boy, that was such a turf target. I think I told you that it was the second most defended after Berlin.
I've heard a lot of stories about Pulaski, the multiple raids
on
Pulaski.
It was very tough. It was the toughest raids that we made because they had 1,300 anti-aircraft guns there, and so they put up a cloud of smoke that you couldn't even see through. Those were all exploding shells, and we had to fly right through them, so it was very nerve-wracking.
Well, I can imagine, yeah, and we've discussed this numerous times on this show with people who served on bomber crews, that when that flak is waiting there for you, you can't do anything to avoid it because you've got to stay in formation.
You have to hold your bomb course because the bombardier can't vary the speed or the altitude. He's got to hold that target. It's an automatic pilot at that time. And he held the course, of course, and then we got over the target and dropped the bombs. So we got through the first one. That was That was our first raid. And then on the 10th raid, we went to Winter Neustadt, a Messerschmitt plant in Austria. And that's where we were, they shot us away from our squadron. We couldn't keep up because they shot out our number two engine. So we were on three engines, and we kept losing about 100 feet a minute, fell out of the formation, so we were all alone. But radar was in its infancy, so they didn't spot us, and we never got attacked later. If it had been later, we'd all been tracked down by the Messerschmitts and shot down. Anyway, I pulled the nose gunner, who's in the right in front of my position, in the nose, and put him on the floor. He had a gash across the back of his head, either from flak or from machine guns, and he was bleeding pretty badly, and he was unconscious. So I put him on the floor and gave him first aid and stopped the bleeding, put a pressure bandage on, and then I was plotting a new route to go to Foggia, which is the northernmost airfield that we were holding at that time. That was our 15th Air Force headquarters. And so that was the closest thing we could do, and we went down the Adriatic right down the middle so there would be no anti-aircraft guns. And luckily I hit the thing right on the nose, and we got in and flew into Foggia and landed, and our flight engineer tried to wet his measuring stick, and he couldn't even wet the bottom of it, so we only had enough fuel for another few minutes. It
Wow.
was amazing.
Well, and I've got a lot of questions about that, but we need to catch our first commercial break here, so we'll do that and pick up where we left off with 88-year-old Wilbur Gomes of Gustine, California. Hometown Heroes will be right back on KMJ.
Hey, this is Paul Leffler, and if you've been listening to KMJ for any length of time, you've probably heard me wax poetic about my hometown of Los Banos at one point or another. Every city has its secrets, and I'm going to fill you in on one my old neighbors have been keeping for 40 years. No matter where you live in the valley, you probably go through Los Banos every once in a while. So next time you're cruising down the 152, pull into Ming's Restaurant. The owner, Paul Cito, has been showing off his skills in the kitchen there since 1968. He has perfected the best Mongolian beef this side of the Great Wall. Delicate rice noodles underneath tender slices of beef with a flavor I can't even put into words. Whether you prefer mild, medium, or spicy, you'll be coming back for more. Ming's is closed on Mondays, so don't say I didn't warn you. But stop in any other day and try the pork wonton soup, Chinese chicken salad, or get everyone's attention with the sizzling chicken and vegetables. The possibilities are endless, but they all have one thing in common. Ming's time-tested commitment to taking your taste buds on a thrill ride. Ming's Restaurant, 435 West Pacheco Boulevard in Los Banos.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Visiting this week with a U.S. Army Air Corps veteran of World War II, Wilbur Gomes flew 38 missions as a navigator on B-24 Liberators. If you've never seen a B-24, you ought to do what I did with my family this last week. Go up to Atwater and Castle Air Museum, where you can get an up-close look at one of those fine airplanes, not to mention more than 50 others. Atwater is just east of Gustine there in Merced County. When we left off with Wilbur, he had told us about this mission. They were bombing a Messerschmitt factory in Austria. Their plane got shot up. They were down to three engines. So, Wilbur, you're the navigator here, and they say you need to plot a course. By the way, you're applying first aid to one of your fellow crew members who's wounded. How did you keep your wits about you to plot this new course and figure out how you guys were going to survive that mission?
Well, I got the Silver Star because I guess I stayed pretty calm and did my job.
How did that happen? I mean, most people, I think, would go into panic mode in a situation like that.
No, I think I got calmer as the situation got worse.
Is that because you were just toughened up milking cows as a young boy in a dairy farm in Merced County? Or is
that's
something?
Right. My father had a small dairy, 50-cow dairy.
You think that's part of it, your upbringing?
I don't know. I don't know, but I was thankful.
What was going through your mind? Because here your plane is obviously wounded. You don't know if you're going to make it anywhere where you can land safely. Were you scared at all in that situation?
Well, you know, I could see the gas gushing out the wings, almost like faucets, you know. So that's when I decided it was impossible to get our last 200 miles that we had to go to our base. So that's when I started plotting a new course. And they called me gallantry in action by saving the nose gunner and plotting a new course. And I had a small wound in my forehead from flak didn't go in deep, though. My wife says my head was too hard. I guess it was. It was right above the right eyebrow. The plaque stuck there, and I had the surgeon remove it when I got back to base. So I got a Purple Heart, and I got the Silver Star on that one mission.
Yeah, that's a pretty good haul. Not that you were looking for it.
Yeah, it sure was.
So Wilbur is a recipient of the Silver Star, as well as the Distinguished Flying Cross three times over, and also the Purple Heart three times over. But this mission, you mentioned getting down there on the runway in Foggia, and you said when they checked the gas level, they couldn't even get a reading. So that means you guys used just about every last ounce of fuel. And what that tells me is if you hadn't correctly plotted that course, you guys wouldn't have made it.
No, we wouldn't. We'd have been dead.
And that's quite a sobering thought.
Well, it is. After you look back, it was. But at the time, you're so busy, you don't think about it.
One of the things I've always been curious about when I talk to guys who've had missions like that, I always wonder what it was like going back out on another mission after you've been through an experience like that. Is it hard not to think about what just happened to you?
Well, it kind of sobered you up, you know. Before that time, you were innocent and thought you could beat the heck out of the Nazis. But after that mission, I had second thoughts.
And did you? Were you able to remain with that same crew?
Oh yeah, the whole crew survived, and we went on. In fact, we did all 38 missions together. We were one of the few full crews that survived in prison camp. Now, there's only one left living in Santa Rosa, and myself, 2 out of 10 are still alive.
And we're going to hear about a couple of these other missions where it didn't go as planned, but I have to imagine that you had a lot of respect for your pilot.
Oh, he loved me. He was an outstanding pilot. The second plane we lost, we were coming back from Ploesti, and you had to fly by Belgrade, which was the capital of Yugoslavia. And they had a large contingent of Me-109 German fighters there, and they came up and started picking us off from behind because, again, we were separated from the other planes. They'd start at the back and get tail end Charlie first, who was the rookie on. He always got the worst spot.
Right.
And then they'd work up the next one, and we were number two that day because we were pretty veteran, and we ended up with just 2 airplanes out of the 7 in our formation. And we saw this, I didn't see it, but I had plotted this course on the top of a mountain in Yugoslavia. And I said, we've got to go there, George. And that was my pilot. We've got to go there. No, we're not going to make it across the Adriatic, which is about 200 miles. So we landed, and the runway was as long as Gustine, which was 2,300 feet. And it took about 5,000 feet for the airplane to stop. And so when he landed, he says he made a perfect landing, smooth as glass. And he yelled, no brakes. So we all got ready in our crash positions. And we went off the edge of the cliff and down a ravine. And the plane broke into 3 pieces. And the top turret came off of the ceiling and landed right on my chest. And, of course, it weighed about 500 pounds, I guess. And I couldn't move, so I was stuck in the plane. And then the next miracle of my life was there was no fire, which is almost 100% of the time when you have a crash like that. I give credit to my pilot for cutting the master switch so there'd be no electrical in the plane. I don't know that for a fact, but I'm pretty sure that's what happened.
And what was your pilot's name?
Well, he was 26, so he was the old man. George Draut, D-R-A-U-T, and he was from a newspaper in Pennsylvania. He was a newspaper man, and when I had my first child, I got big headlines in that newspaper. That was kind of a funny thing. Anyway, they got me out of the airplane. The partisans had to cut the plane, the side of the plane open with axes, and they got that thing off me and pulled me out of the airplane. And I thought I had a broken back, but later I found out it was just twisted. And they flew a DC-3, which they call a 647, or 340. Anyway, it was a
DC-3 yeah.
Transport.
Yeah.
And they flew in there and got us and took us back to Italy, which was a miracle, too.
Okay. This plane tries to stop on a runway that's only half as long as what it needs. It goes over a cliff. It breaks into 3 pieces, somehow doesn't catch fire. And a 500-pound turret lands on your chest, but
I'm
you survive.
I'm guessing the weight, but it's very heavy.
How did you survive that? What do you think happened there?
Well, you know, the force of the landing, it just took it right out of the ceiling of the plane. It was on the top of the plane, and it just fell right in.
I mean, it sounds, I think you used the word miracle, and it sounds a little miraculous that you or anybody survived that.
It is. It's a miracle. I could have burned alive while I was trapped in there, and if there had been a fire, which was 99% of the time.
Did you?
I went to the hospital for 10 days in Italy at my base, and then they checked my back, of course, and it hurt like heck, but they said, there's nothing wrong with your back. Go back on duty. So they put me back on the airplane, and I went back to Pulaski, the first mission where I'd been busted up before. That was a sobering fact, too.
So the very target of that mission,
a tough target, boy,
was your next mission.
And then on that last 38th mission, we got a fire started. They hit us with an aircraft that started a fire behind the bomb bay, and the two waste gunners were fighting that. And then as we dropped the bombs, they started another fire right behind the pilot, which we called the flight deck. I'm in the nose of the airplane, and I can see back. And I see the flames on the engine number two going back over the wing where we had over 1,000 gallons of fuel. So I told George, the fire is going back in the wing. He says, get out, get out. We all bailed out. We were 22,000 feet.
Had you ever bailed out of an airplane before?
Oh, no. Once in my life, and that's it. They didn't give us any training in that at all.
So I have to imagine, in a circumstance like that, that there had to be a little fear that you were experiencing.
Well, you were so darn busy that we only had a 2-foot square escape hatch in the nose of the plane, and it was kind of dangerous to go through it because you could strike your head on the edges. So I kind of was concerned about that, and I swung myself out by my hands, and for some miracle, doing almost 200 miles an hour, I was able to hang on. And the bombardier looked down. He says, let go, let go. And so I did, and you're supposed to wait and see how far you can fall before you try your parachute. But everybody got their chute out as soon as possible.
And you guys were still pretty high up there. What do you think?
22,000. It took, I guess, around 20 minutes to get to the Earth.
So 22,000 feet up, and I imagine that's pretty stinking cold.
You don't have any oxygen at that altitude, of course. It was 40 degrees below zero, so we had flight suits on. I was hanging on there, and then I was in the slipstream of the airplane hanging on, which is a miracle. And finally, my bombardier says, "Let go, let go," and I did, and the thing opened, and very very happy about that.
Yeah, I suppose so.
Yeah, so all of us got out of the airplane all right. They were all captured as they hit the ground. And I landed about 100 feet away from the main group in a cornfield, and I threw off my heavy gear. I had my sheepskin uniform on. I threw that off, and somebody got a nice uniform. And I ran as hard as I could. They had a cart path down through the corn for the one-horse carts. And I ran and ran and ran until I couldn't go anymore. And I went into the corn and laid face down first. And sure enough, there comes a guy on a horse waving a pistol. But since I had my face down, I was kind of invisible in the corn, and he didn't see me. So I laid there for a while to make sure he was gone. And then I started as a navigator, I figured I could make it back across the Danube into Yugoslavia, where the Yugoslavs had these partisans, and they could help us, you know. So I had grand ideas, and we had what they call an escape kit, which had cloth maps in it. And I used that, of course, for my planning. And from 40 below zero, it was almost 100 degrees on the ground because it was August 10th. You know, the temperature was high and the corn was high, about 8 feet high. So I stayed in the corn and tried to get some liquid off the leaves. And it was around noontime, I think. After dark, I started licking the leaves because the dew came out, and I got a little bit of moisture, but nothing to speak of. And I hadn't had a drink for over 12 hours, so I was getting dehydrated. I saw a bunch of, three shepherds shepherding a bunch of sheep along the open land right next to the cornfield. So I stayed in the cornfield and followed them. I says, hey, I'm a farm boy. There's got to be a trough somewhere where they're going. So I followed them and followed them, and then it got really dark. I mean, just black. And so I got down on my hands and knees and tried to blend in with the sheep, which I did, and I could hear these three shepherds all around me, all yelling at each other, of course. And I thought later, if they had found me, they would have thought I was trying to steal the sheep and probably club me to death. I didn't find any troughs, and so I decided I better get the hell out of there, and I crawled out and got back into the corn.
Wow. I'm sure everybody listening is wondering what in the world they would do in a situation like that. And we're going to find out what you did. We need to take another quick break, but when we come back, we'll hear about where Wilbur Gomes went from there, how he became a prisoner of war, how he survived as a prisoner of war to reunite with his wife of 68 years now, Irene. This is Hometown Heroes on KMJ. A high school where 98% of graduating seniors go to college, where success on the SAT and advanced placement or AP classes outpaces almost every other school in the Valley. Home to a student newspaper that hauls in national awards on an annual basis. Its sports teams capture section championships. Have you figured it out yet? The school is Fresno Christian, and it's not just a high school. Fresno Christian offers a complete K-12 curriculum delivered by supremely qualified, experienced teachers who connect with their students personally, intellectually, and spiritually. Go to FresnoChristian.com to learn more about the value of a truly Christ-centered education. And if you want to see for yourself, call 299-1695 to schedule a campus visit. Whether it's kindergarten, high school, or anywhere in between, you'll get a genuine feel for what Fresno Christian's commitment to excellence could mean for your student. That number again, 559-299-1695. Fresno Christian Schools, education with a higher purpose.
This is Hometown Heroes, honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Boy, is the time going by quickly today with Wilbur Gomes, 88 years old of Augustine, California. Maybe you knew him in the dairy business. About a quarter century ago, he was named California's top Holstein breeder, but he wasn't thinking about that back in August of 1944. You heard him describe bailing out of that burning B-24, taking about 20 minutes to get down to the ground. And when we left off, he was hiding in a cornfield. Was this going by quick, Wilbur, or did it seem to last forever?
No, it was pretty slow because I was just dehydrated so bad. Then I figured that there had to be a hose in the backyard like we have here in California. So I come out of the corn, and as soon as I stuck my nose out, the dogs would start barking, come running out to meet me, you know, so I'd have to go back into the corn. So I didn't get any water until the next day, and by that time I was really bad off. I couldn't even move my mouth. I was so thirsty, almost 24 hours without any moisture. And so I went into this. I saw those ladies carrying these big jars of water, and I said, oh, fine. They only have one well in that little village. So I went down, and I headed toward that village, and I got in there, and I was walking toward the well. I could see the well ahead of me, and these two soldiers grabbed me from behind, and they were strong. They just pinned my arms to me, and they took away my pistol. I had a .45 caliber pistol, and they knew about it, I guess, because they yanked it out, and they took me to a little jail as big as Gustine's jail, and they put me in there, and the whole village turned out to peer at me and through all the windows. One lady even slipped me a rosary. She was so sympathetic. So we stayed there, and he got on the telephone, and he did the hello, hello, hello. They had funny phone lines, I guess. He finally got his superiors, and they said, bring him to Bucharest or the prison camp. So he put me back in the one-horse cart, the driver, and he sat above, you know, on a higher plane, and I was down on the bottom on the flat place of the cart. We were heading for Bucharest, and as it got dark again, I started looking around, and the soldier must have figured out I was going to make a break for it. So I cocked that gun and put the shell into the chamber. And I says, uh-oh, that's my bullet. I better keep quiet. So I did. I just lay there until morning when we got there. That's when did I tell you about the slaughterhouse?
Not yet.
Let's go back. The Bulgarians had beheaded some of our flyers. And I thought, gee, maybe the Romanians are going to do the same, because they're right next door to each other. So I was very apprehensive as we approached Bucharest, and he had a friend working in a slaughterhouse, and the thing was a block square. It was a huge place. So he walked me through it, and of course, the meat was hanging everywhere, and I said, oh, God, that's where I'm going to get it. And he took me to the back, and his friend was there, and he was just going to show off his prisoner to his friend. So I just about died right there. And then after a few minutes, he took me back out on the street. We were in downtown Bucharest at that time, and a woman even spat at me as she passed by because we had bombed them quite a few times.
Sure.
The prison camp was right at the edge of the city where the marshaling yards were to take the oil back to Hitler. There's five oil refineries right next door, so they got some of the bombs in Bucharest itself. We go down, and it puts me in an interrogation cage. And this Nazi officer start trying to find out what kind of airplane I was in and where I was from and all kinds of interrogations. And I kept answering Geneva Convention, name, rank, and serial number. Wilbur Gomes, first lieutenant, 07-12-803. And boy, he got mad. He pulled out his pistol and laid it on the table. And he says, you know, I could say you attacked me. And boy, at that point, I just wilted. I mean, it was only the two of us, so he could have shot me and nobody in the world would have known. But he wasn't a bloodthirsty guy, thank God. And he finally got so damn mad, he called the guard and said, get him the hell out of here. He spoke perfect English, so he'd been in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, get him the hell out of here. So they took me down to the prison camp. And as I told you, we had the escape kits on our knee compartment of our flying suit. But they also gave us $50 in American currency, which was quite a large sum at that time. Well, as I got next to the prison, the guys who stuck their head out the second story, it was a three-story building, said, put your money in your shoes, put your money in your shoes. So I could understand, but of course the Romanians couldn't. And so I sat down on the curb and fooled around my shoe, and then I took it off and put the money underneath my foot, and I got it inside. And so that was supposed to be funding a group escape later on. Mm-hmm. And so I saved that, and guards took me inside, and they were already full. It was a three-story schoolhouse built before the war. I found out it was so full that I couldn't have a bed. And they gave me a straw mattress in a hallway and said, this is where you're going to sleep. And I did the first night, but it was full of fleas and lice and bed bugs, and I had a miserable time. So I never used it again. I had to sleep on the floor. The schoolhouse, three stories high, was right across the street from a bakery. And the Romanians would come out in their little white bags and wave them at us just to taunt us that, you know, we were all starving to death. We only got one bowl of gruel, clear soup in the morning and one clear soup at night, which was nothing. We were always hungry. That's all we thought about is how we could eat.
You know, what strikes me is that you're in this situation, and obviously it's frightening, it's uncertain, and it's the uncertainty that I always wonder. How do you go through a situation like that believing that you're going to get out when there's no end in sight and you don't know how long this is going to last?
That's correct. We had no idea when the war was going to end. So, you know, and they had no calendars or anything. We did have one outside source. We had a three-piece shortwave radio, and we'd take it apart every night and hide parts all over so they couldn't find them. That gave us the BBC in London. And we found out that the Allies were making progress across Germany. And in fact, the Battle of the Bulge was a few months later. And so we knew that the war was going well for us. And so it gave us a little bit of hope, but we had no idea how long it was going to last.
You mentioned how the rest of your crew from that B-24 was captured as soon as each one of those guys hit the ground. You were separated from them. When you got into this prison camp, did you find any of your crewmates, or were they somewhere else?
No, the Germans were very militarily minded, and they had put all the enlisted men, which were sergeant and below, in a different prison camp nearby, but in a different camp, and then they had the officers in this camp.
Did your pilot, maybe, or co-pilot end up in your camp?
Oh, yeah. We had that's the only people we knew, each other, you know.
Well, I imagine when you saw those familiar faces for the first time in this prison camp, that had to be comforting or reassuring.
You bet. Boy, I was happy because I didn't know if they had survived or not. I later found out that the tail gunner, who was named Tex from Texas, had a shotgun placed to his head as he hit the ground, and the soldier just pushed it away in time so he wasn't killed.
Wow. So here you are in this prison camp in Bucharest with no end in sight, no way of knowing how long you're expected to be here, no way of knowing whether you'll starve to death or survive to go back and see your wife again someday. How did you get from one day to the next? What kept you going and believing that you would survive?
Well, the days were endless, you know. We had nothing to read, nothing to do, no games to play, nothing, you know. We just sat there like statues, you know, and tried to think about getting out of there, which three of our prisoners did escape. They got as far as the Black Sea, and they were recaptured and brought back to our prison. We had a colonel, Romanian colonel, in charge of the camp, and he lined up all of his guards, which were about 10 or 12, in the yard right in front of us, all the prisoners watching. Then he went down the line and slapped each one of them right hard in the face, which is unheard of, you know, that in our military you can't do that. But he slapped each one of them as hard as he could, and that was their punishment for letting the men escape. He also had a pig in the yard, and he would give his scraps to the pig, you know, and the guards were just about as bad off as we were. They'd go in there and fight the pig for his food. So it was kind of a brutal situation.
How much weight did you end up losing?
Well, I lost 11 pounds in the first 3 weeks. I don't know what I ended up losing, but I was already down pretty good at 125 when I got 20 years old.
Did you ever get any Red Cross parcels?
Well, you know, when we were rescued, we found a room down in the bottom of this three-story schoolhouse filled with care packages, and the colonel had kept them all for himself, you know, and we didn't even know they were there. And that's why we were starving, and he was getting fatter all the time.
Wow. And how long was that before you guys were liberated? When did that occur?
When the Russians were 100 miles away from Bucharest when I was shot down in August, and they came into Bucharest, and their column of soldiers was about a mile or two long. I mean, just thousands of them. And the leader had a full beard, and he had his leg up on a box in the one-horse cart, and he was leading the column, and he had a submachine gun in his hands, and he just kept looking around, just daring anybody to try anything, boy. Nobody moved. And we watched them go through town, and they were not interested in the Americans at all at that time. Later, they became interested in many hostages of the captured Americans, but they didn't do that at our place. So then we were moved by somebody, I don't know who, to an airfield right next to the city. It was Bucharest Airfield. Our commanding officer was a colonel also. He was a fighter pilot, and when he was shot down, and in fact, he was shot down the same day I was, he had a contact with the Romanian pilot who was very sympathetic to the Americans. And so they took and he also had a ME-109, Messerschmitt 109, which was our toughest enemy. Mm-hmm. And they took all the radio gear out of the fuselage and put this colonel into the fuselage face down, and he flew him back to Italy. When he got to Italy, everybody put their guns on him. They were going to shoot him down, you know, Messerschmitt. And he kept dipping his wings around. They finally just let him land. And the colonel went and talked to the general.
Was that General Nathan Twining?
Yes, correct. Nathan Twining was our commanding general. He was the general of the 15th Air Force. And our colonel said, "General, we've got 1,300 prisoners back there. You got to come and get us." And so that sounds impossible to the general, but they took the planks and placed them in the bottom of the B-17s, not the 24s, the B-17s, I don't know why, and they would carry 20 men in each airplane. And they flew 60 of those planes back to Romania, but they had a fighter escort, P-51s, which the Germans couldn't beat. And they landed at our airfield because the P-51s swept the airfield because they thought it might be a trap. And we landed, and they only gave us a minute or two to get in the airplanes, 20 men to each airplane, and we took off immediately and flew the 500 miles back to Italy. And we were sitting there on the boards, and we had no parachutes, and we'd all been shot down by parachute, so we were a little uneasy.
Yeah, that sounds like maybe your scariest flight of all.
Yeah, so it wasn't bad. And we had a good flight, no attacks, and landed at our field in Italy. And they deloused us, and they had us all naked, and we had to burn our clothes. And they sprayed us with that medicine or that poison, and so we were pretty well cleaned up when we finally got our American clothing. And so we were okay, and then they moved us to Naples, which was on the west coast of Italy, and we had to wait for a ship to take us back to the States. And so we stayed in Naples about 3 days, I believe, while they waited for a ship to be available because there was so much activity in Naples. Then they put us on this old French wooden ship that was probably from World War One. It was amazing because every time it moved, it creaked and creaked, and we were sure it was going to fall apart, but we were happy to get on there. And we took 2 weeks to reach New York. 2 days before we arrived in New York, we caught the tail end of a hurricane which had come right across the coast of the Atlantic, right along toward New York. And that ship started to creak and crack, and we thought, boy, this is it. We had to stay in our bunks because you couldn't stand up. It was such a rough sea, you know, and the strain on the ship was unbelievable, but it didn't fall apart. But it did. On the way back, we found out that it had foundered in the middle of the Atlantic. They had to tow it into the Azores Islands, so we were lucky. As we got back to New York, we were taken to a base there in New York, and they dispatched us to our homes. So that was the end of my great experience.
And that is a really remarkable experience. I've interviewed dozens of prisoners of war, and you may not have been in captivity as long as some of them, but
was very short.
Yeah, this is about a month, I guess, huh, or less than that?
Yes.
But to be rescued in that fashion, I mean, this is pretty daring. This is like the stuff you'd make a movie out of or something.
That's exactly right.
Were you fearful at all as you guys are rushed onto those B-17s and flown out of there? Were you afraid that the Germans were going to get you?
Oh, yeah, we were quite apprehensive because we had no defense at all, just sitting in the bottom of that airplane. So we wouldn't have had anything. We had no chutes, no nothing, just completely at the mercy of the plane.
If that rescue, and obviously it could have backfired, the Germans could have intercepted you, all kinds of things could have gone wrong. But
oh, yeah, because we had to fly clear across German-occupied Yugoslavia.
And so it was a very daring operation.
But oh, it definitely was, and I'm just amazed even to this day that the general agreed to it.
Have you ever thought about what would have happened to you if the general hadn't agreed to it, if they wouldn't have come after you? What do you think would have happened to you?
God, I have no idea. The Russians would probably have grabbed us.
And I've talked to some guys who are in Russian captivity, and it certainly was no picnic. So you're a free man again. I imagine that had to be quite a feeling and probably something that you were hoping and praying would happen.
Oh, you better believe it. Freedom at last. We were the first large group of POWs to be released, and the war lasted until April of the next year.
Most POWs that I've talked to, yeah, they didn't get liberated till April or May of 1945. Here you are in September because of this courageous act by the colonel getting out of there to take the message and the general to approve such a risky operation.
It was risky.
That's really remarkable. So for you, where did the story go from there? What did they do with you?
Well, we got to go home, of course, and being in California, I was on a train for several days. Finally got to Modesto, where I was picked up by my wife. And they gave us a leave, I think 30 days, something like that. Then they sent us to Santa Monica to a hotel, what they called R&R, and we stayed there for a month. And they tried to figure out what the heck they were going to do with us because we were all, you know, pretty valuable war veterans. We knew a lot about the war. So they sent me clear across the country again to Orlando, Florida, and made an intelligence officer out of me. And then they shipped me back to they said, you're going to get the best base that there is in the United States. Well, they lied because it was Alamogordo, New Mexico, where they set off the bomb, the first atomic bomb, and we were there.
You were there when they did that test?
Definitely. I was briefing, they used us as briefing officers. So I had my back to the big square window, and all of a sudden the room lit up, you know, and I said, what the hell was that? And we turned around, and this great big cloud of white smoke, I guess, we didn't know what the heck had happened. But next day we read in a newspaper that an ammunition dump had blown up. So we bought that. But that was the atomic bomb, the first atomic bomb, July 16th of 45.
Absolutely. And about a month later, a little less than a month later, it would be dropped on Hiroshima.
Yeah.
You know, not too many people have lived through what you've lived through. But I want to ask, before you ended up in Orlando and in Alamogordo, when you just set foot on American soil again, how great of a feeling was that? And was that something you wondered if you'd ever have a chance to do again?
Oh, no question. I was so elated. I was almost out of body. I was so happy.
And how long was it before you got to see Irene again?
When I sent from New York to California, she picked me up, and so I was with her until the end of the war, actually. We went to Alamogordo together, and that was also an experience because there was no housing at all. We ended up in a chicken house with 12 other couples, one bathroom and a wood stove to heat the water. It was almost as bad as the prison camp.
Well, at least you had her by your side this time.
And they told us that you're going to get the best duty there is, and it was the worst. Now, oh, no, one more thing. I guess the radiation from the atomic bomb must have been coming toward Alamogordo, which was a very short distance. And so all of a sudden it says, we're out of water. You got to leave immediately. We're out of water. So I had the little Chevy, it's a 46 Chevy, and we headed out over the mountains to Las Cruces, New Mexico. And halfway up the mountain, my generator went out, so I had no lights. And I had a flashlight, and I had to lean out the window with this flashlight. And we finally made it through the pass, and I got down to Las Cruces. Of course, there was no beds there either. So we had to sleep in the car, and Irene was, let's see, how many months pregnant at that time. My daughter was born in December. This was July. Well, she was pretty far along in her pregnancy, and so it was a tough night for her. We were in a car, and there was no room. We had everything piled in the back seat. Anyway, we got sent to Tucson. That's where they discharged me, not discharged me, but sent me home. And then I had to stay home for, not had to, but I was home for, I don't know, about a month or so. And then they sent me to Camp Beale up near Sacramento, where I got my discharge. When I got to the last guy, he says, I can make you a captain right now if you'll join the reserves. I said, no thanks. So, you know, you'll come in as a private if you don't. I said, I already did come in as a private, so I'm not worried about that. And it was a lucky thing because some of our crew got sent to Korea. Mm-hmm. And they were short of navigators, so I would have gone. That's all you need.
When you think about this now, how incredible. What do you think the odds are that you and every other member of that crew that you flew all those missions with would survive the war with everything you guys went through?
Oh, I can't believe it. I always billed myself as the luckiest guy in the Army. We came so close so many times.
And you mentioned your wife being pregnant with your first child.
Yeah.
How many kids and grandkids and great-grandkids you have now?
Well, we only have two daughters, Diana, which was the first born in 1945. Patty was born in 1947, and she had two boys, and one of them is now up in Portland, where he's the promotion manager of the Portland Timbers, a soccer team.
Yeah.
And he has pretty good position. He's a vice president, and he got the contract with Alaska Airlines for $7 million, and so he had some pretty big clients. And we are very proud of him. We watched him play the other night. Unfortunately, the L.A. Galaxy beat the Timbers. So they're second in the league, and the Timbers are pretty close to the bottom.
None of them would have ever been born if you didn't survive everything you went through.
I guess.
That's pretty crazy, isn't it?
It is. I consider myself the luckiest man in the world.
What's the most incredible aspect of it to you? What do you think blows you away the most when you look at everything you endured?
I had plenty of time later to reflect on it, and it was unbelievable, actually, that I had survived. I kept saying, I'm the luckiest man alive.
You feel like somebody was looking out for you?
I'm sure of that. I still thank God every night.
Well, I don't blame you. Do you feel like you had a different outlook on life after surviving everything you survived? Like you didn't take as much for granted anymore? Or how would you characterize that?
Well, it's hard to say. I came back to Augustine, which was after I graduated. I was an accounting major at Cal. And I got back to Augustine, and I started my own accounting firm. First one they'd had in Augustine, I asked the banker and the newspaper owner what they thought about the idea of having an accounting office. Oh, there's no need for it. No need for it at all. There's no way you can do it. So I went ahead anyway and became very successful.
Well, when you look back on all of it now, when you think about those missions where it easily could have ended your life, if not your entire crew. You think about being a prisoner of war, the daring rescue carried out to take you guys back to freedom, and the life that you've been able to lead since then with children and grandchildren. What would you say you're most thankful for all these years later?
All of the above. Boy, I mean, I've had a charmed life. I know that. Just being 88 is a charmed life.
And being married for 68 years is quite an accomplishment.
Yes, it is. And she worked with me in my accounting office. After 10 years, then I decided I wanted to go back in the dairy business. So I started a dairy with 3 little calves, 3 months old, and ended up with 800 cows. And I had purebreds that I think was the second largest purebred herd in the United States.
Mm-hmm. You want to share with us the secret of being married for 68 years?
Perseverance. Yeah, I mean, you have some rough spots, you know. You can't be together. In fact, as she tells people, we were working together 8 hours a day at the office, and then we were home the rest of the time. So we're actually together 24 hours a day, and that's a strain.
Well, I'm glad you found a way to make it work.
Yeah, it worked. It worked good.
Well, I just want to thank you for serving our country, and thank you for telling us your incredible story.
Well, I sure thank you. I didn't think anybody was interested now after all these years.
Well, I think a lot of people are, and I hope they let you know about it. Wow, what a story with Wilbur Gomes, 88 years old, and a lifetime of stories to tell. If you listen to this show regularly, you know how out of the ordinary those experiences are and how really incredible it is that he survived all of that. We have more information for you at kmjnow.com if you want to see some pictures from that rescue of the prisoners of war from Bucharest, Romania, back in September of 1944. You can hear a little more of the interview with Wilbur that didn't fit into the program today at kmjnow.com. And I hope, of course, you'll join us again next Saturday for another edition of Hometown Heroes on KMJ.